Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you along today as we take a look at prairies and native prairies and native plants with our guest, Neil DeBole, a prairie nursery in Westfield. Neil's been with us many a time. I know this time of the year, weeds sometimes become a problem. I'm sure we'll be dealing with weeds in the prairie and in your prairie area, your native among your native plants. We'll also talk about just getting a prairie started and certainly take your questions and comments. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Neil DeBole, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Great to be here.
You know, we've done this before, but I think it bears repeating. Why should we use native plants in our landscape?
Well, there's lots of great reasons to use native plants. And I can encapsulate that with what I call the four E's.
Mm-hmm.
Aesthetics, if you'll accept Webster's second spelling of aesthetics. You can't have three E's and an AE. So we've got aesthetics, we have ecology, we have energy, and we have economics.
Okay.
The aesthetics, there are some beautiful native plants out there.
Are there ever?
And they were overlooked for years and years as we used our garden models from our forebears who immigrated here from Europe or Japan or China or wherever. And so we created nice, beautiful gardens from France and England and China and Japan, which are all wonderful and great. But we ignored our native flora. So we have some great plants. And then the ecological aspects are numerous. One is, with native plants, you don't have to worry about whether they're adapted to your region. They're tough as nails as they already, if they're planted in the right place. You don't have to use all kinds of chemicals, fertilizers, herbicides. You might have to use some herbicides to get started, but you don't require that generally for maintenance, except when you have a serious weed outbreak in isolated situations. You've got the advantage of the deep-rooted prairie plants increasing absorption of rainfall into the water table instead of running off. Like a lawn has a depth of 3 to 5, 6 inches, and prairies have very deep roots, which create really a sponge effect, so you're recharging your groundwater, reducing flooding. And you also have the support of all sorts of native insects, pollinators, et cetera, which are the foundation of the food chain for birds, butterflies, and all kinds of wonderful garden visitors. And energy. Mm-hmm. If you look at the lawn, you generally have to fertilize it. Where does that come from? There's energy associated with that, especially nitrogen, which is generated through the Haber process, which uses large quantities of natural gas to take nitrogen out of the air to create nitrogen fertilizer. Phosphorus, which usually comes from long distances, Chile or wherever. Yeah. So you have a significant carbon footprint on delivery of those materials. And then all your pesticides, et cetera, most of them are generated from petrochemicals. So you're just using oil to put indirectly to make your lawn look nice or whatever. And then you have economics. Done properly, you can save a lot of money with a native landscape. So there's a lot of good reasons to do this.
Lots of good reasons. Somebody told me once, this may be apocryphal, but somebody said, you know, if the average lawn with a two-cycle lawnmower, you're gonna do as much polluting in one mow of the lawn as if you drove your car from Madison to Chicago.
Oh, I think it's more than that.
Is it more?
I think it's more than that. Yeah, the numbers are astronomical. Now, you can't buy a two-cycle lawnmower anymore.
No, I don't.
I used to have an old Lawn Boy. It blew up last year after 25 years, and I was really sad and really happy because it was one of those two-cycle oil burners. I felt guilty, but that's why I hardly mow my lawn. And I hadn't used it for 3 years. It sat there, and I fired it up, and it went 10 feet and exploded.
I love it. Well, I use an electric one, so I don't have any gasoline, at least, or oil used on it. Oh, man. Annabelle in Madison has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Annabelle. Annabelle, you know what? It would help if I turned on the microphone. So I'll do that right now for you. Go ahead.
I planted a
You are totally breaking up.
Oh, shoot.
You planted a prairie, I heard that, a few years ago, is it?
4 years ago, and now I've got a lot of that coming out in there, and I don't know what to do with it. I don't want to.
Yeah, okay. So it's crown vetch, I think, or vetch.
Vetch, yeah.
Vetch, sorry. She's not sure about what to do about it.
If we would need to know if it's vetch or crown vetch, because there's a significant difference. So,
is it vetch, Annabelle?
Or crown vetch?
We just can't get her.
Well, we can discuss both of them. There are many different vetches, and there is the genus Vicia, V-I-C-I-A, which is composed of, I think, about at least six species that occur in Wisconsin. And they are generally early successional species, meaning they colonize an area in the early years of, say, a prairie restoration or any kind of a planting.
Okay.
Some are longer lived than others. They generally are pretty easy to pull out by the roots, although, I mean, they're not necessarily terrible unless they really go crazy and take over. And they have nice purple flowers, so they're not the end of the world. Crown vetch, on the other hand, is a thug. Crown vetch, of course, was planted, it was a great answer for stabilizing slopes because it's very aggressive and it creeps by rhizomes. And once you've got it for life, whether you want it or not. So it's impossible to dig out crown vetch unless you basically take a backhoe in there and remove all the roots because of these little rhizomes, and you leave a little piece of rhizome an inch long, and voila, it's right back. It also self-sows by seed. So you have the double threat of the killer weed, rhizomes and seeds. So what to do? Oh, let's go out and spray it with Roundup. Guess what? Crown vetch is resistant to Roundup or glyphosate. So now if you are reduced to using herbicides, you have to use a broadleaf herbicide or a combination of broadleaf herbicide and Roundup. What's the problem with that? That's going to kill everything in the area. But usually by the time you've got a patch of crown vetch, there's nothing left because it's smothered everything. So now let's say you have some nice prairie grasses mixed in with your crown vetch. By using a broadleaf herbicide, you will only kill the crown vetch and not the grasses when used properly. So there are some options, but it is extremely, extremely difficult to kill. And people who have tried to smother it organically find that it takes 2 to 3 years of smothering crown vetch to kill it because those roots are so extensive and are able to survive 2 or 3 years underground with no light when they come back. So it's something, when you find it on your property, you want to get rid of it right away.
Right away.
Nip it in the bud. If you have a small patch, you might be able to dig it out. Okay, but you might have to pull a few other plants near it or very carefully spray those little patches before they get started. With a broadleaf herbicide, Roundup won't kill it.
Pete in Red Granite has a question. Pete, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a farm with about 40 acres that I'd like to transform into native prairie, perhaps even oak savanna. It's high, it's sandy, it's rocky. It was soybean fields last year. What should I do? How do we go about doing this?
Okay, is the whole 40 acres was a soybean field last year, Pete? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you're really in luck because cornfields and soybean fields, especially soybean fields, are generally about as weed-free as you can get. They're not necessarily going to be completely weed-free, but usually with modern farming practices, most farmers are using Roundup-ready beans and Roundup-ready corn where they nuke the bejesus out of everything in there, and so there's almost no weed growth left, which, is not the greatest ecological method for producing food, perhaps, but it is a great way to get your ground ready for planting a prairie. So what you want to do before you do anything, no matter what your situation is make sure you evaluate what kind of plants are out there, if anything is left, after being in beans and corn. So you want to make sure you don't have any perennial weeds that have survived the cropping over the years. Know what those species are and understand what it takes to eliminate them. For instance, let's say a common weed that we find is quackgrass. And quackgrass, and the problem with quackgrass, not unlike the crown vetch, is it is also a rhizomatous perennial, and it creeps by runners. And quackgrass can creep 3 feet in 1 year. It's really something else. So you can't just go out there and till quackgrass because you'll chop it up into little pieces, and then you spread it all around, and you have more quackgrass. You can't just plow it because you plow it under, and then it comes up from 7 inches, 8 inches under. And so you have to come up with a strategy to kill that or any other perennial. Some people will use herbicides like Roundup or glyphosate. Some people who want to do this organically will use organic methodologies like smother crops. And this works very well. On sandy soils, clay soils, any soil, you can use buckwheat as a smother crop, which you plant after the danger of frost is past, which is usually in June. We had a pretty nasty frost last week.
Yeah.
So, and that will kill the buckwheat. You plant buckwheat at about 60 pounds per acre with a seed drill. And it will grow for a couple of months and start to flower. and then you cut it back before it makes seed, because if you do not cut it before it makes seed, you will have buckwheat for life, because it's very adept at self-sowing. And then it'll usually be, if you plant it in mid-June, 2 months later, you probably cut it down around mid-August, and you plow it under, and then you plant a crop of winter wheat in September. And then you run the winter wheat through the winter, and then into the next spring, and then when it starts to head out, usually in early June, you plow that under, cut it down and plow it under, and plant another crop of buckwheat, if you have. And this is what we use for an old field, not your situation. Yeah. You're in a better place. But let's say I have a field full of quackgrass and weeds and stuff.
Yeah.
If you do this two-year organic buckwheat winter wheat rotation, by the second fall, you will be ready for a fall seeding, or if you prefer a spring seeding, you can plant a second crop of winter wheat in the second September. And this will eliminate almost all weeds, because the thick, broad leaves of buckwheat smother the plants below by depriving them of light. So it's an organic method that was used before the advent of herbicides. And you read the old farm books. Yeah. I read these farm books from the 1880s, 1890s, and wow, this really works. And I've used it, and it's very effective. And if you have a really poor sandy soil or a heavy clay soil, you are green manuring it.
Yeah.
You're putting in all this organic matter in the forms of the buckwheat and the winter wheat that you're plowing under or tilling under. So you're improving the soil while you're killing the weeds. So that's an effective method if you don't want to use herbicides. But in your situation, because the field was in soybeans, you probably have limited weeds. You may, if you want to use herbicides, let the weeds come up until they're about 10 to 12 inches tall. That's the point at which quackgrass, a common weed, is readily killable using glyphosate. Spray it once, which will probably be in the next couple of weeks, and then you can go in and plant your prairie, assuming you don't have any really problematic weeds that are resistant to Roundup, like Canada thistle, crown vetch, which we talked about earlier, and sometimes you'll see field bindweed. Usually don't see that on sandy soils, but these are three broadleaf weeds that are resistant to Roundup, so you would have to use a broadleaf herbicide that rapidly degrades after you spray it, and then you have to wait a couple of weeks or whatever the time is required for that broadleaf herbicide.
10 days or whatever.
And then you can go in and seed it. If you can't do the whole 40 acres at once, then you're going to want to put it in a holding pattern. If you say, well, I can only afford to do 5 acres per year, well, put in that 5 acres of prairie and keep the farmer cropping that field to keep the weeds down. Uh-huh. And this is another method for people that have a large acreage. And like, oh, my God, I can't afford to spray this all for years, every couple of years. Just have a farmer come in and plant corn and beans. And usually they'll pay you for that. So that presupposes that you're okay with them using genetically modified crops and herbicides on your land. If you're not in favor of that, then you have to find an alternative way to manage that. And what some people do is they just keep it mowed a few times of the year, and don't mow between usually April 15th and July 15th, because that's when grassland birds are nesting. So most of the birds are off their nests by the middle of July, and then you can start your mowing process to prevent weed seed formation, to at least keep the situation from getting worse. So those are just a couple ways that you could do that, and I hope that answers Pete's question.
Yeah, thanks, Pete. Thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting about fruit trees. So I hope you can join us for that conversation. Right now, taking a look at native plants with our guest, Neil DeBull, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Great to have him along, and thank you again for listening in. We have Joya in Fitchburg up next with a question for you, so let's go there. Joya, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question for him, two questions. One is, I had a butterfly wheat plant. I think 3 years ago I put it. It's in a sunny spot, close to the mailbox, but it bloomed for 2 years, but then it's not coming back this year. I don't know what happened, but it's not coming back, and local people tell me it's hard to keep up with it. I know, it's whether I should wait another month or so. I also have some seeds of the butterfly wheat from last year. I'm wondering whether I should put them at the same spot or in a different spot.
Okay. What do you think, Neil?
I think you need to wait a little while, because we haven't really had any warm weather, And we get this question a lot, Joya, because the butterfly weed is a hot-blooded flower. And it's got that orange flower. It's hot-blooded all the way around. It does not come out of the ground until the temperature of the soil really warms up. And we haven't had that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a problem here, but my butterfly weeds have not come up yet. And I'm on sand, which warms up fast. They are still sleeping away. Oftentimes, butterfly weed will not appear in a cool spring, will not appear until June. And you wonder and wonder and wonder, when are those guys going to come up? And they usually will finally emerge. Now, butterfly weed, undisturbed, will usually live between 10 and 20 years, any individual plant. Average is probably around 15 years. But if you have some kind of a perturbation or problem, there are critters. I don't know if they're voles or whatever. Sometimes voles will eat the root, the crowns off, and you'll see where they've gnawed at it. And sometimes then you get fungus in there after it's been disturbed, and that can actually lead to death of the plant. But butterfly weed is a pretty tough customer, and if its top gets chewed off, the top of its roots and new buds get chewed off, it will often produce new buds around the side of the root and rebranch out and come back. And sometimes you might not see it for a year because it's been disturbed, and it'll just take the year off, and then the next spring you go, wow, here's the butterfly weed. It's miraculously been raised from the dead. So it is the reason why butterfly weed is tricky is because the butterfly weed that grows naturally in Wisconsin grows on sandy, well-drained soils. And if you plant butterfly weed in a heavy clay soil or a wet soil, that's basically
not going to like it.
It's a kiss of death. Now, at Prairie Nursery, we have a special strain of butterfly weed that was given to me by a wonderful woman in Milwaukee who rescued it from a prairie in Racine County, growing in a heavy clay prairie. And she and a friend dug this up, the root 3 feet deep. She took it home, put it in her garden, nursed it back to health for 3 years, and it finally bloomed again. And she gave me some seeds from it. And we've been growing that for 20 years, and it's called butterfly weed for clay, and it really does grow in clay.
Wow.
So I need to thank Babette Kiss for doing that. She provided that, and we've now been able to provide that to people so people can grow butterfly weed on clay with our butterfly weed for clay plant.
Wonderful. Joya, thank you so much for calling.
Oh, she asked also about planting seeds.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah.
A native begonia plant?
I don't know any native begonias myself. I mean, I don't know every single native plant, but...
I don't know a native...
But you can plant the seeds.
She's got the seeds because she just put them...
Yeah, and you can put those... They need open soil. Okay, you know, like starting any plant.
Disturb the soil a little bit.
Yep. And, work up the soil, make sure there's no weeds in the area. Butterfly weed, being a warm-blooded plant, germinates best in June when the temperatures are warm. And if you want to increase germination, there are dormancies in butterfly weed and many other prairie flowers, as well as woodland flowers. If you take the seed and mix it with some clean sawdust that's been slightly dampened, you don't want it too damp. If you can squeeze water out of it, it's too damp. And mix the seed in with 3 or 4 times the volume of clean sawdust. Put it in a Ziploc bag. Put a date on it and the name of the plant. Put it in the refrigerator for 2 to 4 weeks. And then take it out, and it will miraculously go from 20% germination to 90% germination. So that's how you can make the most of your butterfly weed seed and many of your other prairie flower seeds.
That is very cool. Joya, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give some other callers a chance to join in, but just a reminder here, Neil DeBoll, our guest today. Neil is with Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, and now we go to Dave in Janesville. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I've got a native prairie, and I've been battling crown vetch for almost 25 years. However, last fall, it was late in the season, I used Transline on it. I thought I'd be too late. I haven't seen anything of it this spring.
Yep, it's the way to go. And spraying in the fall is the most effective way because plants are translocating energy down into their roots. They suck up that herbicide when you spray it on their leaves. They take it right down in the roots, and it's adios amigo. So if you have a real problem weed, the time to spray is usually in September, assuming that it is still green and actively growing. But, of course, be careful because you can kill all the good guys, too.
I went real late, so I wouldn't kill the good guys. And, again, I didn't think it would be effective at all, but it was probably early November.
Really? That's fantastic.
And Janesville.
Yeah. So a lot of your prairie flowers were already dormant, and so they were not affected.
Yes, and it's looking great this spring.
That's great. That's fantastic. What was the air temperature when you did that, Dave?
Oh, I don't recall.
Because usually you need about 55 to 60 degrees Fahrenheit for most herbicides to be effective. Now, I don't know about Transline, if you can go below that.
Again, it was so late, I really wasn't putting much faith into it.
Yeah.
It did the job.
That's great. Excellent.
Thanks, Dave. Thank you for calling. And Jerry in Coloma, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I have about 100-square-foot sandy area that I put Roundup on last year, and then I worked it up, and I planted prairie grasses from Neil's nursery. And now this spring, I am covered with a small type of a prostrate or spotted spurge. I'm wondering if I should just round up everything again or what I should do about it.
Okay, a spotted spurge. Has it bloomed yet? Are you sure it's a spurge?
It's in the process of blooming, yes.
Okay, and is prostrate creeping along the ground?
Yes.
Okay, and does it have kind of green and reddish tinged leaves?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, have you pulled one up?
Oh, yes.
Okay, does it have a little taproot about 3 inches long?
Or less, yes. Uh-huh.
Or less. Okay, that's probably an annual.
Okay.
And I'm assuming it's a what we call a winter annual. It germinated last fall.
Right.
And it will bloom, and it will probably be there this year, and you might see a little bit next year, and then it should be gone.
All right, so I shouldn't worry about it.
No, what you want to watch out for is something like leafy spurge, Euphorbia
acula. I'm familiar with that, but that's not there.
No, okay. Then actually, that's a good plant. And there are some good weeds. You know, as Dorothy said, are you a good weed or a bad weed?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or actually, Glinda said that. Sorry. Dorothy answered that. So there are good weeds, such as the prostrate annuals, such as what you've got. And then there's also things like carpet weed, Malugo verticillata, and purslane, Portulaca oleraceae. These are actually fantastic weeds, and they're very common on sandy ground in our area. And they cover the soil. They're annuals. They have a little taproot. They almost are non-competitive with the prairie flowers, but they cover the soil, retain moisture, and create a perfect germination bed under their little carpet of leaves for the prairie seedlings to germinate.
Okay.
There we go. Thanks a lot for calling. And Connie Joe emailed and wondered, would some of the shrubs in your catalog make good foundation plants?
It depends on what you want in a foundation plant. Okay, a foundation plant being a plant that is planted around foundations to screen concrete, foundation, etc. And some of the shrubs get 25 feet tall, so that might not be exactly what you want. But yes, there are some lower growing shrubs, such as New Jersey tea, which gets about 2 to 3 feet tall, and it has pretty dense foliage. So if you're looking at a foundation plant, you're going to want something that's dense, not loose and open. For instance, the lead plant would not be generally a good foundation plant because it has a looser, more open growth form. Okay, so you're going to want to look at shrubs that are 3 to 5 feet tall that are going to obscure the foundation, provide you with good dense foliage, and not get out of control. So if you have a dry sandy soil, there's a plant called sweet fern, which gets about 3, maybe 4 feet tall. It does creep by rhizomes, so give it some space to run. And make sure that if you have other plants that you want it to be next to, you may not want to choose that. And New Jersey tea does not do that. And New Jersey tea likes a really well-drained soil. Don't put it in clay. It likes more of a sandy loam. Okay. And it'll grow in full sun to partial shade. If you have a damper soil, you can use steeplebush, Spirea tomentosa, which has a beautiful pink flower. It has a pretty dense canopy. Gets 3 to 5 feet tall. It's one of my favorites. And it's a later season bloomer. A lot of your shrubs bloom in spring, in June, but the steeplebush blooms in August. So it gives you later season color. So black chokeberry is another great plant. Aronia melanocarpa usually gets 3 to 5 feet tall, might get a little bit taller. It grows on clay. It's a pretty tough customer. It grows in a lot of different situations. It's got a pretty good, dense shrub-like canopy.
All right, so some good options
yes,
there, then.
But don't plant like smooth sumac, okay, which is a great plant for planting in the back area, but it'll creep all over the place, and you will rue the day you planted it near your house. And also other creeping plants that get a little, adventurous. You might want to avoid those. So those are just some good possibilities for foundation plantings.
Well, let's go to Glenn in Amherst Junction next then. Glenn, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you, Larry and Neil, both for a great program. I have a kind of a twofold question. One has to do with milkweed. Our garden's been over the years, we're shrinking our family, and our garden is too big, so I've been letting the milkweed kind of move in, and I've been propagating it to the point where I don't rototill in that area,
mm-hmm.
and it does create quite a large root system.
Yes.
Now,
We're going to be gone for a few weeks, and we're not going to use that part of the garden for a while. So last fall, I planted it heavy into winter wheat, and it grew about, and I did it late, probably October. It grew about 6 inches, then it died, and then now it's come back, and it's come back really thick, and it's about, 14 inches tall right now. And I was just going to let that part of the garden in winter wheat for the month of June and then come back and deal with it. But my milkweed is in amongst that wheat. So is that wheat going to kill that milkweed?
No. Don't worry. No. Don't worry about it. It's common milkweed, I presume, right?
Yep, just common wild milkweed.
Yeah. The wheat is going to maybe kind of set it back for a while and reduce its growth, but you're going to be hard-pressed to kill common milkweed. Common milkweed is an interesting plant, and historically it was considered a weed. I love how whoever named most of the plants that we sell as weeds, you know, it's like really bad marketing. Butterfly weed, milkweed, joe pie weed. But that's just because they were, you know, not an economic crop.
Yeah.
So not because of their behavior or anything like that. Well, in the case of common milkweed, most corn farmers considered it pretty bad, but now they just blow it away with Roundup Ready crops, which is why you have a problem with monarch butterflies, among other reasons. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, a common milkweed usually starts as a patch and expands out, as you've experienced, and then it will gain steam for about 10 years, and then in the next few years, it kind of just peters out, and this whole clone will slowly disappear if it's in competition with other grasses and plants. So it's kind of a mid-successional perennial, and then as the real heavy hitter, long-term plants that live 30, 40, 50 years take over, it tends to reduce in populations and may even disappear in the latter stages of, say, a prairie planting or just old field natural succession. So, but you're going to get a lot of good years out of that milkweed patch.
All right. Well, and I have a question with the winter wheat. Maybe you can answer for me, too, since we're talking a little bit about winter wheat. If I go into that winter wheat patch that I have, it's, you know, maybe 100 by 30, if I go in there with a weed whip and I clean out a couple of spots to put some squash, what I weed whip there, will that come back, or will that be dead?
It depends on the timing. Most annuals, which wheat is an annual crop, if it gets into the seed formation process when you cut it back, that will usually kill it. But oftentimes, if you cut it before that, it will oftentimes resprout and continue to grow, because its goal as an annual is to make seeds, and it's going to do everything in its power to accomplish that, because if it doesn't, it's a failure. So the timing of that cutting is going to probably determine whether you're able to kill it or not.
Before it seeds out.
Well, you want it. If you cut it before it seeds out, it's probably going to resprout.
Okay, good.
Okay, but after it starts to form seed, if you cut it back, you're probably going to pretty much set it back.
Okay. Super.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Good luck.
Thanks
a lot. Hope you get lots of monarchs.
You know, I was really struck by your comment about the having weed as part of the name of some, you know, if you'd called it milkflower instead of milkweed or butterfly phantasma or something.
You'll see a lot of catalogs call it butterfly plant instead of butterfly weed. And I will tell you a funny story. We have a plant that we sell. It's called Hellenium autumnale. It's a beautiful wetland plant. Nice yellow flowers. Its common name is sneezeweed. We couldn't sell this thing. We couldn't give you money to take it. And I said, you know what? This is a great plant. And it actually, there's a reason why it's called sneezeweed, is because if you crush up the seeds, or actually the seed heads, it was used to help and promote sneezing, to clean out your nasal passages. So you crush it up and then you inhale it through your nose and you start sneezing like crazy. So there really is truth to it. But if you just walk around the plant, it's not going to bother you. So we changed the name to Dogtooth Daisy, and we sold out instantly. And a lot of people call it Helen's Flower, because sneezeweed is a pretty tough sell.
I love it. Oh, man. Well, here's another. Carolyn from La Crosse has a question about another plant that has an interesting name, too. Carolyn, hi. Thanks for calling.
It's a pleasure to be on the program.
And what's your question about?
The Burlington Northern Railroad seeded the rail right-of-way last summer with Wisconsin DOT number 30 mix, and it has bird's foot trefoil in it. And now it's creeping into everybody's property that is adjacent to the rail right-of-way. And we're wondering what a safe alternative is to treat our backyards.
Oh, boy.
Define safe.
Well, we want it. This area drains into our wetland. We have a La Crosse River marsh here, and anytime there's rain runoff, there's also a golf course. Rain or snow melt, everything drains down into the wetland, and we're concerned about safe for people, pets, and then all the plants and animals in the wetland.
I think you should sue Warren Buffett and his Burlington Northern Railroad for ecoterrorism.
Well,
by planting
agree,
that plant. But that's a separate issue. You've got a problem. And I've seen this before. When the county comes and plants crown vetch mixes along roadsides and it creeps into my customers' prairies, I mean, it's inexcusable. It's absolutely inexcusable. And the fact that anybody is still planting crown vetch to this day is beyond the pale. I mean, why don't you just go out and, you know, just throw ragweed? And actually, ragweed is nice compared to this stuff. So now you're stuck, and as a previous caller called, he's had success with using Transline, which is a broadleaf herbicide. A lot of people would not consider that safe because it contains halogenated hydrocarbons in it. That will be a personal choice as far as whether you want to use it. But spraying it very late in the season, if you just have other grasses in there, then you can spray a broadleaf herbicide pretty much any time in the summer or fall, which will not harm the grasses. If there's no native forbs or flowers that would be harmed by it. But once that's in there, it's almost impossible to dig it out or pull it. People have tried that, and it doesn't really work.
I wonder if it'd be if we could get at the source. I mean, the people who are putting these seeds together. I mean, you would never put it bird's foot trefoil or
no crown vetch bird's foot
trefoil. Yeah. Why do people put that in?
Because it's in the book. It's in the specs that were written 20, 30 years ago. You would not believe the junk I see come across my desk. People just go in and they cut and paste and throw it in there and, okay, well, this was in the book, so we use that. It's unbelievable. And they still use these things. I'm working to rewrite the DOT specs for prairies, but they don't ask me anything about the other non-native species. So, but they really have a responsibility to not propagate these weeds. And, you know, my stuff is called weeds, okay, but crown vetch is truly, truly a terroristic weed. Okay?
Yeah.
And it should be on the federal noxious weed list, but because it's a commercial crop, it is not. And I think that's politics and economics.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really, really bad. And anytime I encourage my customers, people say, oh, should I plant crown vetch on this slope to stabilize it? I said, well, if you want the rest of your landscape to be ruined in a period of time, yeah, go for it. But most people don't want that. And this was something that was sold extensively. And it really does work. If you want to stabilize a hillside, it really works. But be careful, it won't just stay on the hillside. So if you want to have a good neighbor policy, you never, never, never want to plant that stuff.
Carolyn, thanks again for calling. Appreciate you calling. Good luck with that bird's foot trefoil. Jan in Mosinee has a question for us. Jan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, good morning. A twofold question, please. And that is, putting milorganite on your lawn, will that hurt the birds? Because I've got robins and cardinals that are, you know, picking away at the grass to get worms. Will they eat that milorganite and possibly get sick?
That's a really good question. You know, milorganite is brought to you by the good people of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, from the sewage treatment plant. And they used to have problems with heavy metals, but they've isolated that now, so that's no longer a problem. I'm not an expert at milorganite, but I would be very, very surprised if there was anything in that that would be toxic to critters, because it's, you know, used on people's lawns. Of course, people use all kinds of weird stuff on their lawns. But their whole reputation is that it's organic and non-toxic. But, you know, you might want to go to the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District website and just look at, just Google milorganite and check out toxicity of milorganite on birds, et cetera. I would be very surprised if there was an issue with that, however.
Yeah. I'm with you.
My second question is, please, because I've got Creeping Charlie that really came back very viciously this spring, and the hardware store sold me a concentrate of Ortho Weed Be Gone, and they said to spray it on there. It may need two applications, but they said it definitely will take care of Creeping Charlie. Is that also harmful to the wildlife?
That depends who you believe. And if you look at Weed Be Gone, it's got some pretty strong chemicals in it. A lot of people will tell you to avoid that for health reasons. I'm not a person who can, you know, I'm not trained as a chemist or as an epidemiologist. I don't use that stuff on my property, and there are studies that would indicate that there are potential health hazards with many of the chemicals that are sprayed on our on our food crops.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 2,4-D is a commonly used broadleaf herbicide to kill weeds, and I would say probably 90% of America's wheat crop is sprayed with 2,4-D. Now, it does dissipate rapidly and break down, and I don't think it's ever really, I don't know if it's been documented to be actually in the seed itself, but still, we don't really know. And it's something I would prefer to avoid. So I buy organic whole wheat bread. I don't eat that, that white junk in the store. But anyway, I would personally not use it, but that's a personal judgment. And there are those who would say it's perfectly safe, and there are those who would say run away from it. In my food garden, Creeping Charlie crawls into my vegetable garden. So every year I go out on the edges and rip it out by hand, and of course it comes right back. And Creeping Charlie is a never-ending problem. And even after you kill it and you can spray it two or three times, the dormant seeds in the soil will almost always germinate, and it will come back, and you'll be dealing with Creeping Charlie forever.
I think I said this one other time on the show. Years back at another place, I literally got entirely rid of my lawn, which was full of Creeping Charlie, got rid of the entire lawn, reseeded, put down a whole new lawn. 2 years later, I was full of Creeping Charlie again.
Lawn maintenance companies love Creeping Charlie.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Creeping Charlie, violets, dandelions. You know, violets are really hard to kill. My lawn right now is half violets.
No.
And I love them.
Yeah.
And people say, how do I get rid of violets in my lawn? I'm like, man, why would you want to get rid of these beautiful violets? It's like a harbinger of spring. This is fantastic. Of course, you know, I don't spray my lawn. I don't really don't mow my lawn. I have a no-mow lawn. So it's a little wild out there, but I'd much rather look at violets than lawn grass. And all the bees and the pollinators love it, too. So what
there
the
you
heck?
Go.
What the heck?
Julie and Eau Claire, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. A quick comment and a question. I also love the violets in the lawn. I love the butterflies, and several years ago I left a nice sized little patch of milkweed that was on the bottom of my garden where I didn't grow anything, and I am still regretting it. You don't want that milkweed anywhere near your garden. It comes up everywhere. And then I'd like your opinion on, I also love catnip, and I know the bees love the flowers, but I noticed we used to not be able to find the stuff, and now should that be kept out of the garden and let it grow elsewhere?
That's your call. Catnip is a pretty invasive plant on my property. It loves my rich sandy loam soil in sun to semi-shade with a high pH. It goes crazy. So, and it's very interesting when you have these high pH soils in southern Wisconsin, really high pH meaning 7 to 7.5, not that high, but catnip and motherwort, Leonurus cardiaca, these plants just love that. And so they're never-ending weeds in my little woodland planting, so I'm yanking them out all the time. But it's a matter of opinion. You know, if you like catnip, and people make catnip tea, and you can give it to your cat and watch them go crazy. I mean, there's all sorts of good reasons to have catnip. But in the garden, I don't have catnip in my garden, but that's up to you.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Julie. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, our guest for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We have a link to his website on my Facebook page, our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. Great to have him along. And certainly if you have questions, finally, we have some open lines. You can get on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Trying to stay with nurseries with native plants and woodland gardens today with him. And we'll go to Annette in Green Bay next. Hi, Annette. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Neil. Neil, I'm a longtime customer of yours. I just bought a bunch of seeds I was going to put into my prairie that I just burned a couple of weeks ago. It's a one-acre prairie, about 8 years old. This is my second burning that I've done. And I have a problem with reed canary grass invasion. And I thought I was going to be able to just, kill it off right now and do some seeding later in the year. But now I've got some geese in there that are eating the grass, and I'm kind of happy with that. So what do you think is worse, geese eating the grass or the reed canary grass taking over? I mean, I'm just trying to figure what's a good way to deal with this reed canary grass.
When you say get rid of the reed canary grass, what methodology were you going to use on this, Annette?
Well, I was going to mow it and then, you know, use Roundup or something and just really go after it because there's not much else you can do with it. But now I've got these family of geese in there, and they're eating the reed canary grass. So
I know some people that would like to rent out your geese.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, if you want it, if you like the geese, I wouldn't bother them. I let them keep doing their thing. And are they nesting there?
Yeah, there's a family of, I think there's four little ones, and then, of course, the parents are. So is geese eating the reed canary grass for a year, is that effective enough? And can I just, I'd love to just let them keep doing that. You know, it's certainly better than using Roundup.
Sure.
But is that going to be a long-term solution? And then I was going to plant some, I bought a couple $100 worth of seed I was going to put in because the reed canary grass and, I hate cup plant, I'm sorry, but they have taken over, and I'm also getting rid of them. And the geese are not eating any of the other plants that are coming up, so that's nice. So are they a good deterrent? And
sounds like they might be the goat of the bird family, huh?
Some people call them the rat of the bird family.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, I would just let them keep doing their thing. And the most effective way to control reed canary grass as is true of most herbaceous perennial weeds. If you're going to use herbicides to kill it, you're going to want to do that in the fall when the energy of the plant is going down in the roots and it will translocate the herbicide downwards. So spraying now can be moderately effective, but it probably would not completely kill the reed canary grass because the energy of the plant is still coming up in the spring. So I would just let the geese do their thing, have their family, and they will then leave the area once the goslings are adults.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to hang around. And then you can come in the fall. And if you're going to hit reed canary grass, the best thing to do with that is to cut it down around August 1st and let new growth come up and then go in about when the vegetation is 12 to 15 inches tall, which will probably be mid to late September. And then you can go out there and hit it with Roundup. You can use other herbicides to increase the effectiveness of the Roundup. You can use Imazapic, which is an addition. You can put that in with the Roundup. Or there's a couple different herbicides you can use, but that combination will really knock that stuff out. So I would wait until mid to late September after cutting it August 1st, and you should really dispatch that reed canary grass. Now, of course, any valuable plants that are in there are going to go with it. So if you have flowers in there, you can use grass selective herbicides like Cefoxitin, also known as Post. A close relative called Clethodim is also very effective when used in the fall using the same method. However, it usually will not completely kill the reed canary grass, but because it's a grass selective herbicide, it will not harm any prairie flowers in the area. And another trick here is if you mow everything down in August, your warm season prairie grasses, which are also being, if they're in there, mixed in there, they will be killed if you spray it with these grass selective herbicides such as Cefoxitin or Clethodim in September. But if you wait until the prairie grasses go dormant in October, the reed canary grass will stay green later in the season because it's a cool season grass. And once those prairie grasses are completely dormant and dry, you can go out on a 60-degree day and spray the Clethodim or Cefoxitin onto the reed canary grass as long as it's still green and actively growing and get pretty good kill on it without harming your prairie grasses or your prairie flowers.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling, Annette. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 1-800-642-1234. And when you do, our on-air producer, Brandy Funk, will answer the phone and talk with you in a very friendly way, as a matter of fact. So great to have her help today on the program. And, of course, Jill Nadeau, our producer for the day as well. Zach in Milwaukee is our next caller. Hi, Zach.
Hey, guys. I've got a question about this. Well, it's like a wild blackberry that I keep seeing around in southeastern Wisconsin, and I guess is it a wild blackberry? I don't know if you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we have wild blackberries. You have wild raspberries. They're in the genus Rubus, and they get about 3 to 5 feet tall, and they have arching stems, and they have lots and lots of sharp prickles on them, right?
Yeah.
And when the tips hit the ground, they root and create a whole new colony. Correct.
Yeah.
That's usually
I'm
what you see.
I'm not positive about that.
Yeah.
They're typically in the woods around my house, and then I'll just go out there and pick them. But I was thinking also, would I be able to take, like, cuttings of them and then root those and then plant those? Or?
Oh, yeah. You can't kill that stuff, man. Yeah. 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 What you do is normally you would do this in the spring. You can just take a 2-foot section of it and cut it off and then stick it in the ground in this early spring and it'll probably root in. It'll spread like crazy. Most people call it how to get rid of it. So it's interesting that you want to grow it. But it's great for wildlife. A lot of wildlife utilize the berries. It's not very user friendly for human beings, but it's a great plant for birds and all sorts of critters.
Reminds me again of woodland gardens.
Woodland gardens, yes, and getting the raspberries out of the woodland garden, unless you
one thing.
if you want to walk through it.
Oh man, and good plants for woodland gardens.
Oh, so many different opportunities. When you look at native plants for woodland gardens, you've got a wide variety of wildflowers. Not just your spring ephemerals. You know, people think of woodland gardens, they think trilliums and bloodroot and stuff like that, jack in the pulpit. But you have actually quite a few other woodland plants. There are many asters and goldenrods that will bloom August and September, which really extends the interest of the season into the latter part of the year. There are a few, we offer a few non-native, non-Wisconsin natives, like fire pink, Silene virginica, which is a great red pink flower that blooms in August, July, August. You've also got some heuchera's. We have some, they're alum roots from a little bit farther east over in the Appalachian Mountains, which are fine here. One of them is called maple-leaved alum root. It has beautiful purple-green foliage, and then it has a nice white flower that blooms in August. So you got a lot of flowers for later in the season, as well as the spring ephemerals, and you've got ferns. Some wonderful ferns that look good all year long. Most of the ferns we offer are very well behaved. There is one ostrich fern which likes to creep and crawl, so make sure that's in an area you want lots of ostrich fern. Don't put it in I put it in my garden and I'm yanking it out all the time. I love the plant, but it doesn't play well with others. And then you've got all these wonderful sedges and grasses. Sedges are usually fairly low-growing, grass-like plants, and there's a wide variety to choose from for your woodland for that, too.
And if you're thinking about a woodland, when I think about woodland, of course, I think about a bunch of trees. And planting amidst or among those trees can be, I mean, you have to watch it a little bit because you've got the tree roots to worry about.
Woodland gardens are much more difficult than prairie gardens because you can't go out there with a tractor and do 40 acres. And you can't use equipment between the trees and rip up the ground. You have to be, as you point out, Larry, it's really... You have to be really, really careful. And some trees are more forgiving, and some trees are very unforgiving if you disturb their roots. Like white oaks, if you mess with their roots, oh, man, watch out.
They do not like that.
They do not like that. No filling, no ripping, nothing. So you got to usually work on a small scale. And the other thing is that prairie seed is readily available and relatively reasonably priced. Yeah. Woodland seeds tend to be available in small quantities because most of them are hand-harvested. They produce very small quantities per plant. They're not easy to propagate mechanically, so they're available in low quantities at high prices. So many of our customers start small, and they put in plants to create patches of wildflowers or wildflower gardens in specific areas, which is much easier. Now, I grow a lot of stuff at my house, and so I have these production areas for my woodland plants, and then I collect the seeds off of that, and I go and plant, you know, a few thousand square feet with that. And I'll tell you that it is a lot of work. Okay, and I don't want to oversell this. If you're going to start woodlands from seeds, first of all, some of the seeds are double dormant, like trilliums and Solomon's plume. A lot of these seeds, they have to sit in the ground 2 winters before they even germinate, and then they grow an inch tall the first year, and 2 inches the second year, and then 4 or 5 inches the third year. And I have a patch of trilliums that I planted from seed about 10 years ago. It's finally starting to bloom.
Wow.
So it's really, really a long-term process. For those species, some are faster. Columbine will bloom in 2 years. So there's a lot of different options there. But just dealing with, and then you have to deal with the weeds, like garlic mustard, buckthorn, honeysuckle. I have to kill the area off. I have a terrible buckthorn history on my property, and I get rid of it. But the birds come from the neighbors and sit in the trees, and the seeds get pooped out in the ground, and voila, I've got more buckthorn coming up in my woodland garden. So it's much more challenging than a prairie garden.
But when you get those trilliums, I mean, when they are blooming.
Oh,
Oh, man.
I love my Woodland Ground. There's bluebells and trilliums and bloodroots, and it's just, it's fantastic. It's absolutely fantastic. Throw in a few ferns, and it is the most wonderful thing to see. It's right outside our living room window, one of the transplant gardens, and it's just a highlight in the spring.
Oh. And I do remember your comment about white oak is really, white oaks is really well taken. I was thinking back to a few years back where housing development, it was all white oaks in the area, and they kept the white oaks, which about 3 years later all died, or 2 years later all died.
They disturbed the roots, bulldozed around them.
And so they went from a wooded area where people paid quite a premium to have those aged white oak trees, and then they all died.
Yep. You got to be super careful. And that's the problem. If you're going to do it, a project like that, you have to fence off the trees so the crazy guys on the bulldozers don't go in there, because they don't know. Nobody's trained them. They just move dirt. Okay. I mean, there's some exceptions, of course.
Yeah.
But usually, if it's not very clearly fenced off, people don't know, and they just go drive their equipment, and just driving a bulldozer and trucks compacting the soil will kill white oaks and some other trees as well. So, yeah, you got to be really sensitive to that.
Our guest today, Neil DeBole. Neil is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We have a link on our Facebook page to his site at the Larry Mueller Show. It's just, if you can just go to Prairie Nursery, type that in, you're going to find it. Great to have Neil with us here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. We're visiting with Neil DeBole, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Great to have you along today. We have all of our lines filled at 1-800-642-1234. So we'll turn to Judith in Wausau, I believe, next. You have a question for us.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. We have in our backyard a rather stately green ash that the prior owners of our property surrounded at its base with bishop's weed. And in order to, guard the health of the tree as much as possible, we want to get rid of the bishop's weed. I'm thinking to pull it out by the roots, maybe rake around there and put some gravel in the circle that was cleared. Is that a good idea?
Well, a bishop's weed is not an inherent threat to the ash tree because it has deep roots where it can get water and nutrients. So the bishop's weed might compete slightly with it, but as far as I know, there's no toxic effects on the ash tree. What you do need to be concerned about is emerald ash borer, and that is your big threat. And emerald ash borer, I believe, was just recently found in the Wausau area, which means that you are running a race against time. And the problem with emerald ash borer, and I'm not an expert at this, but I have a couple ashes that I'm protecting on my property, and you don't see the results for 2 to 3 years after it is infested, and by then it is too late. So you need to take treatment to prevent infestation of the emerald ash borer. And there are a couple different ways to do that. There are methods of injection, which usually last for 2 years, and you need to talk to an arborist about that unless you know how to do that. And there are also drenches that you can put around the base of the tree, and that has to be done annually. And the cost to do this is based upon the diameter of the tree when you have an arborist do it. And the amount that you need to use also is based upon the diameter of the tree. You have to be careful because some of these They're insecticides to kill the emerald ash borer, and some of them are neonicotinoids, so you want to be very careful about which method you choose. Again, I'm not an expert at this, but you can hire, I would suggest that you consult an arborist or do a lot of homework on how to do that, but you would want to do this pronto, immediately this spring, now, if you want to keep that ash tree.
Right now, as a matter of fact. Good luck, Judah. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Don in Manawa next. Don, hi. Thank you for calling.
Well, thank you very much. See, I've been following Neil for a while and try to follow his advice on burning prairie. And this year, the fire restrictions went on so long that I did not do it yet. And I'm wondering if it's too late to do that. I've got a lot of greenery out there.
Yeah, this is an established prairie, Don?
Yes.
How old is it, if I might ask?
About 5 years.
Yeah, you probably have some plants that are already just starting to flower in your prairie or getting ready to. Is that correct?
Well, I don't see any flowers yet, but I see greenery.
Normally, we recommend for best results, burning your prairie to control cool season weeds, tree and shrub invasion, usually mid to late April. This year, I didn't burn some of my prairies until the first week in May because it was a little bit of a cool spring. The best way to really coordinate that is when the buds of the sugar maple are opening. That is always a good, reliable method. And you'll have a few prairie flowers that are just starting to come up. But meanwhile, most of your cool season problem weeds are coming up and will be more damaged by the fire than the few prairie plants that are up. However, you are now past that point significantly. And if you burn now, what probably will happen is you will do some real damage to the quack grass and mm-hmm. the brome grass and the bluegrass and the clover or whatever you might have for cool season plants. But you will also do significant damage to some of your, especially your earlier blooming flowers. And your asters and goldenrods, interestingly, tend to be set back by a late spring burn. You will then probably favor the warm season grasses, which are not really very active yet. So you're going to preferentially harm a lot of your flowers without doing a significant amount of damage to your warm season prairie grasses. And you will probably push the balance of your prairie more towards the grasses and against the flowers for this growing season. So if it were mine and I like the flowers, I would not burn it at this point.
Well, that's kind of good news. I have one less task to do then.
All right, there you go. Saved you some work.
Thanks, Don. Say, looking over at our Facebook page, Steve sent us a photo of a very pretty little flower.
The fringe gentian.
Yeah.
The elusive fringe gentian.
The little, is it purple or is that blue?
It's a blue. It's a beautiful blue. And it has little fringes around it. It's kind of a short-lived perennial, usually lives maybe 3 or 4 years. It's very specific about its habitat, and it's not the easiest thing to grow in the world.
It's pretty, though.
It's absolutely gorgeous.
If you want to take a look, go to our Facebook page. Our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show, and look under the comments, kind of in the middle of the page, and click down there on that, and you're going to get that photo and some other, several other photos as well.
Yeah, congratulations, Steve, who grew this. That's pretty. That's an accomplishment.
Pretty cool. Ann in Dalton up next. Ann, thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I have quite a healthy patch of burning nettle in an out-of-the-way corner of the horse pasture, and I was going to get ready this weekend to spray it, but I'm wondering, it's not bothering us per se. I know it spreads, but is this a plant that I need to, that provides some sustenance to, say, a butterfly or a moth?
Or a bee.
Pardon?
Or a bee, I said.
Or a bee. Is there any reason I should just leave it alone?
Yeah. If it's not bothering anybody, leave it alone.
Okay.
And there is a butterfly. I'm not a Lepidopteran. I think it is a red admiral or a tortoise shell. I'm feeling really bad here that I can't tell you what butterfly. But there is a butterfly whose caterpillar depends upon the stinging nettle for its growth. So if it's not bothering anybody, leave it there and hopefully you get some butterflies. And stinging nettle or burning nettle also makes a fabulous soup.
Can I eat the leaves now, make a soup out of it now, or was
yes.
I supposed to do that when it was really little?
Well, you want them as young as possible, but you can get away with it now. Now's not a bad time. And check out, there's tons of recipes online.
Okay.
And make sure you wear gloves.
Yes.
Okay. And you definitely need to cook it. Don't eat it raw. You'll have quite the little tangy surprise.
Well, that I know.
There you go, Annie.
That's what I wanted to know.
You bet. Good
Thanks,
luck.
Thanks, Annie. Pat in Wisconsin Rapids, on to you now. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Our neighborhood has an infestation of garlic mustard weed, and I was just wondering if you would be able to tell us what the best way to get rid of this is, if it's with Roundup or pulling it.
You're the question I've been waiting for all day. Garlic mustard. Well, as I was explaining previously, I live on a buckthorn garlic mustard farm, which I've been slowly converting into native plants. And interestingly, when you cut down all the buckthorn, it allows light to the soil, and then the garlic mustard explodes. It's kind of like, man, how many times do I have to roll this rock up the hill and have it? So, yes, I have a program of elimination of garlic mustard, and I've got a pretty good handle on how to get rid of it. And the first question is, do you have other valuable vegetation in the area, or are you just looking at a complete mess where there's nothing you want to preserve, there's no good wildflowers, grasses, ferns, or anything else in there? What is the situation on this?
There are a few ferns, but there's also creeping Charlie and violets.
Okay. Well, violets, I love violets, but do you want to preserve any of this other vegetation?
I guess not necessarily.
Not if you can get rid of the garlic mustard.
Let me give you your options, because I think this is going to help all listeners, okay? You basically have three methods to deal... Well, actually, you have four methods to deal with garlic mustard. One is pulling, which is not my favorite because it's really labor-intensive, okay? Yeah. Two, and you have, if you have an area where there is no valuable vegetation and you want to convert it to something better, is spraying. And Roundup is perfectly acceptable for killing garlic mustard. And you can spray it in flower, you can spray it in summer, you can spray it in fall. As long as the temperature is 60 degrees Fahrenheit, between 60 and 85, you can kill it with Roundup. There also, if you have valuable grasses or sedges in the area, you can use a broadleaf herbicide that will not kill your grasses and sedges. And so you can be selective about it. You have burning. Okay, and well-timed burning can really do a number on garlic mustard, especially a late spring burn just before it's in bloom or as it's blooming. That can really hammer. The problem with that is if you have valuable wildflowers in there, they're blooming at the same time, and they're going to get hammered by that fire too. Some people burn in the fall. It's good at killing seedlings that germinated that year, but it won't kill them. It's good at killing the small seedlings that germinate late, but not the ones that germinated earlier. It will just burn it back, and they'll come back next spring.
Okay.
Here is an organic method that I use. And I discovered this on my own, and then I did a little research and found a Nature Center in Ohio had the exact same results, so they have corroborated this. Pulling garlic mustard is kind of self-defeating because every time you pull it up, you disturb the soil, thus creating more habitat for dormant garlic mustard seeds to germinate. Garlic mustard seeds have been documented to stay viable in the soil for 8 to 9 years. And I can attest to that on my property because where I have areas that were just a disaster. I mean, it was buckthorn, and then it became garlic mustard. There was no valuable native vegetation whatsoever. I just go out there and spray it with Roundup once every year, usually in June. And I'm usually able to kill pretty much all the weeds, et cetera. Well, before I plant seeds, I do this for 6 to 7 years. And the garlic mustard? Yeah, that's crazy, isn't it?
Wow.
You got to be really patient. But I want to get the numbers of garlic mustard down. And after 6 or 7 years, I have very few garlic mustard plants germinating because I've been really getting rid of the seed, exhausting the seed in the weed seed bank. Then I will scatter the seeds in the fall, the woodland of my desirable woodland flowers, grasses, sedges, etc. And then the more garlic mustard comes up the next year, and you have to go out and pull it. And then the buckthorns come up from the birds sitting in the trees. You got to go pull those, and the honeysuckles, and the motherwort, and the catnip, and all the other bad guys, and the raspberries. So it's really pretty labor-intensive. And that's why a lot of people put in transplants rather than doing seeds on large areas like I do. But what you can do in an area where you have valuable plants, you can't spray. Pulling is a lot of work. I go out with my hand scythe on the kind on a handle.
Yeah.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
You can use a weed whacker. I don't like the sound of the weed whacker. Seriously, I don't mind the sound of the chainsaw when I'm cutting buckthorn, but I don't like the weed whacker. So I will go out there and hand scythe the seed heads off of the garlic mustard just after it has finished blooming, which is coming up in about 7 to 10 days in the next week or two. And this is typical of most biennials. Sweet clover responds this way. A lot of your problem weeds in prairies, burdocks, a lot of them, bull thistle, if you whack their seed stalks off just after they finish blooming, the seeds are not yet mature, so you do not have to worry about removing the cut material from the site. They will not form viable seeds. Plus, you've disconnected the seed stalks from the root, so there's no energy to finish the seed formation. If you pull garlic mustard out of the ground, well, it's after it's finished blooming, the root and the leaves can transfer energy into the seeds, and sometimes they can form viable seed if you leave them on the site, which is why if you pull garlic mustard after it's bloomed, you have to remove it from the site. But if you whack their little heads off and take it down to the leaves, not only will you prevent seed formation, the leaves on the plant will die. Mm-hmm. You'll come back 3 weeks later, and where it was solid garlic mustard, all you will find is dead garlic mustard leaves, plants at the base. And you didn't have to use any chemicals. You just whack their little heads off. And when you have valuable plants, you do your best to whack around the good guys. Yeah, I cut a few trilliums off sometimes, but this is a really good organic method to control the formation of seeds and to kill the garlic mustard. You're going to have to do this for a number of years.
Yeah.
Because they're going to keep coming from the dormant seeds. But this is a great organic method, and you don't have to get on your hands and knees and pull everyone and take them off the site. Like, And another little trick is if it's in bloom and it's starting to make seed pods, you're pulling. If you have a small area, you pull them. You just pull off the seed pods and the flowers from the stem and you don't have to remove them from the site because there's no connection to the root that's going to form the seeds. And you save all that bagging and removal from the site, which is a huge waste of time.
Yeah. Well, that's a very cool idea.
That sounds great.
So these are your options for controlling garlic mustard, depending on your situation and whether you want to use herbicides or not. But you don't have to use herbicides to control it.
There you go.
Okay.
Good
great.
Luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Pat, for calling. Appreciate your call. We've spent a lot of time talking about how to get rid of things today on the show.
You know, that's the name of the game, Larry, is before you plant your prairie seeds or your woodland plants or your woodland seeds, the trick to success is to get rid of all the nasties before you put your seeds and plants in, because the more prep work you do, the easier it's going to be afterwards.
And Donna from Verona had emailed, and, you know, she's got about an acre of a turf grass lawn, and she wondered if she could just plant the seeds right within the grass and what she would get.
Not much.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's a really good ecologist, and he's done it on his property, and he's just throws seed into his lawn over 30 years, and he's getting a prairie now. But it's taken him 20 to 30 years. Why is that? Because you got to think like an attorney. Possession is 9/10 of the law.
Yeah.
If the lawn has possession of the soil and growing environment, it's going to keep it. And whatever weeds are there, whatever, they're going to keep it, especially perennials. So you can go out and throw thousands of dollars of seed on your 1 acre lawn and get relatively low results. But you don't have to necessarily go and rip everything up. And here is a very simple method. This is a lazy man's prairie way to convert a lawn.
Okay.
Okay. This presupposes that, and if it's a small area, you can just smother it with cardboard or whatever. Put that cardboard down, well, a month ago, April, before the lawn starts growing, and leave it there all year. And then in the fall, you can go and scatter your seeds into the dead sod. This presupposes you don't have any weeds that will not be killed by smothering, which include Canada thistle, field bindweed, crown vetch, the usual suspects, the really tough guys, okay? So it was just lawn grass. And usually you can usually get quackgrass killed in 1 year if you start early April, all the way through the end of October into November, by smothering. I don't like to use black plastic because black plastic comes from oil and it's really hard to recycle. Nobody wants dirty black plastic in their recycling. So you can smother it on a larger area. You can spray it with Roundup. Now, the earlier you start, the more the turf and the thatch will break down over the summer. So for best results, I start spraying in like right now to kill the lawn. And then more weeds will come up and stuff will germinate in there. And you just kill it two or three times. Just don't let the weeds get started. And so then by November, it's just brown, dead turf. And you scatter your seeds into that. Now, it doesn't hurt to put a one-inch layer of nice, clean straw, like winter wheat straw, over that planting. Because remember, you're just putting the seeds into the dead sod. It's not really going down in the soil. The seeds will work their way down into the soil with a freeze-thaw cycle over the winter and sort of position them for germination the next spring. But if you can put an inch and a half of clean straw, like chopped and blown straw, so it doesn't blow away. You know, if you go out with a straw bale and it's kind of loose, it blows away. So you really want to chop it up or roll over it, you know, roll it with a vehicle or something. And that will really create a cover for the seed so it doesn't dry out next spring when it germinates. So it's a dormant seeding, planted in the fall. It's a lazy man's method. No tilling, no soil disturbance. And this works particularly well on hills where you don't want to till.
Very good. And once you get those seeds in, do you have to water? Or what do you do?
That's another beautiful thing about fall dormant seedings, is because you're planting in the fall, the seeds come up on their own schedule in the spring. The exception to that, where you would want to water, is if you have a dry spring. Like in 2012, if you didn't water your prairie in 2012 during that drought, you didn't get good results. In a normal spring with normal watering, especially if you put that layer of straw on it in the fall, that holds the moisture in, just like any mulch planting, and it's as low maintenance as possible. So it would be very rare that you would have to water it after seeding.
Colleen in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Colleen.
Hi. I have a beautiful patch of Solomon field, and I'm trying to expand that patch to other areas of the garden. And I'm just wondering if, separating some of that out would be the best way to do that, or trying to harvest the seeds. I don't know how to harvest Solomon field seeds, so just wondering the best way to expand that.
Okay, so you're looking at either transplanting it or harvesting seed and starting it from seed, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, you have a couple options here. Solomon seal and the genus Smilacina are rhizomatous members of the lily family, and they are very easy to propagate by division, but you would want to do this in the fall. You might be able to get away with it now, but when the plants are actively growing, that's really dangerous. Wait until they're dormant in October and dig them up And you can break them into like 6-inch long rhizomes and transplant them wherever you want them, and you'll get new Solomon seals in those areas. If you want to grow them from seed, that's a bit more daunting because, like many members of our native lily family, the seeds are double dormant, and you'll collect the seeds when they turn purple. If this is a Solomon seal, so they usually turn purple. Then there's other members of the Smilocenus, some turn red, so it depends which species it is. But you'll see when they get purple or red and they get juicy and they're not hard to the touch anymore, they're ripe. Really simple. And there are some materials in the pulp of the seed that supposedly prevent them from germinating right away. So you can clean them off. You just take a hose and run them through a screen so that the seeds do not go through the screen. The screen is smaller than the seeds, and you just wash off the pulp. Mm-hmm. And you take the seeds and plant them in the ground where you want them to come up. And in 2 years, after 2 winters in the ground, they will germinate. And they're quite reliable. It's just that they take forever, and they grow very slowly. And about 7 or 8 years after you plant those seeds, you will have blooming Solomon seals.
Okay,
so
great.
You might want to divide them this fall and get much quicker results.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Colleen. Appreciate it. As you know, I know you had a busy spring this year, lots of orders and things. But were there some things that stood out in terms of what was being ordered, or new things, or what was going on this spring?
I'll tell you what really sold like crazy this year was the genus Asclepias, the milkweeds.
Oh.
People are really, really taking the monarch crisis seriously, and people are taking action on their property. And it's a wonderful thing to see. And we way increased our production of plants last year, anticipating a strong sales. And it's gone. It's been sold out. You know, a lot of them were sold out weeks ago. And I would say if anything really stands out, it's the milkweeds.
And if we're planning right now, if people were going to do something in the next 2 weeks, what have you got for us that would...
Oh, you can plant prairie seeds all the way to the end of June. Some people even plant you can plant up to July 15th if you have water available. And you can put in transplants. We like to usually have plants in by the middle of June for spring planting. So there's still another month to put in your plants. Make sure you do have the ability to water them. Because if it gets dry in the summer, you will want to definitely be able to give them a shot of water every once in a while. But there's still a month or more of a planting time. Make sure that you've got all the weeds controlled before you put in your plants or seeds, though. So if your site is not ready and you've got perennial weeds in there, make sure you take the necessary action to eliminate them before planting.
And if you're like Margaret, who emailed and want to get rid of your snow on the mountain...
Oh, my gosh. Don't plant that stuff. Ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Run away. Oh, my God.
It's the worst.
Those rhizomatous ground covers, and they look really nice, but if you don't want them, they're really hard to get rid of. If you don't want to use chemicals, you have to smother them for at least a year.
Cover them up with cardboard and hope for the best.
Exactly.
Well, tell you what, it's always a great time. And what's your site address? I mean, we've got a link on our Facebook page, but if you go to prairienursery.com.
www.prairienursery.com. And if you don't have access to the internet, you can always call us and get a catalog at 1-800-476-9453. 1-800-GROW-WILD.
1-800, and it's 1-800-476-9453. Always a pleasure, Neil. Thank you so much.
My pleasure being here, Larry. Thank you.
Neil DeBoer, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Wasn't that fun? I tell you what, he really knows his stuff, and obviously we'll get him back, and we'll do this all over again with him. Talk some more about prairies and native plants. And just to look ahead, next week on Garden Talk, we'll visit about fruit trees, so I hope you can join us then. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.